Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Nerd! Association. Nerd! Association. Nerd! Association. Nerd! Association.
That was such uber ponage.
Hello, fellow nerds from the studios of WBNS Radio in Columbus, Ohio. This is the Nerd Association podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Barnett.
And I'm your other host, Mark Finch. And Daniel, I had the chance to see this movie in theaters. It was my first go back into the theaters. So that was pretty exciting, especially for Jen and I, my wife, because we really loved going to the theater. So having that taken away during the pandemic was one of the biggest things I noticed from a personal level. Luckily, I didn't have to deal with any major sickness or anything. So
yeah,
the thing I missed the most was the theater at the time. So it was really nice to go back. But let's jump into it.
Yeah.
What do you think of when I say...
very good. Well, that boy, that was what a quiet place in the audio that was,
right?
No, I think about A Quiet Place Part Two. You and I were talking ahead of time. I never quite loved the movie theater experience even before the pandemic, so full disclosure, I have not been to the theater to see this, and Paramount, that is, you know, distributing this film, they have started to break the mold of having things stream simultaneously to them being in the theaters. So on Paramount Plus, you will be able to watch this movie beginning July 12th, 45 days after the theatrical release. So that means that I'm operating in the dark here, if you will. I'm going in a little bit blind as opposed to a little bit deaf. And
right.
But I have seen A Quiet Place Part 1. I trust Chops to lead us. And I think... I'm familiar with the plot because, as you all know, I eat spoilers for breakfast. So, So let's jump right into it. So, to give us your impressions. I mean, so this is your first movie in a movie theater for a year and 3 months or something like that.
Yes.
Was it satisfying? Was it a satisfying one to jump back in with?
It's a good movie experience because, especially because of the conceit of the movie, and there's more dialogue in this one, but it's still very quiet. So seeing in a movie theater, dark in a movie theater is really helpful. We luckily didn't have anybody who was being distracting in the audience. We saw it at like 12:30 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a very crowded theater, which, you know, double bonus for that based on, I don't want to be in the most crowded theater, but I do want to go back. And it's nice to not have anybody who just wasn't there to see the movie being distracting or anything.
Right.
But this, and some of these opinions, if you saw my Chops movie review on this on Twitter, or you heard it on Bishop and Laurinaitis, some of these things are going to sound familiar because, well, I can only have my own opinions.
Correct.
So they're going to sound similar. Difficult to achieve distinction, but it gets it. It's a pretty good sequel. They do the things you need to do. They expand on characters. They expand on the world. They give you more information, but they don't go too big and like all of a sudden the government's there and we're taking, you know, they don't do anything like that. It's still very much about that family, but they spread out a little bit more and they're looking now for a little bit more solution because at the end of the first one, there they are. Their father or the husband is dead. They can't stay where they've been staying because it's been compromised and now there's plenty of loud noises around it. So they go out looking for what's next for them.
Yeah, this reminds me a little bit of, you know, you're talking about the mistakes this movie didn't make. And it makes me think a little bit of 28 Days Later versus 28 Weeks Later.
Right.
Remember, Cillian Murphy, common connection between those two.
And the biggest difference between those two is John Krasinski still wrote and directed.
Correct. So yeah, there was the three.
That's
line.
What happened to 28 Days Later, big hit, awesome. And the studio goes, well, look, we got to make another one. And the studio just took it.
Yeah.
And made a sequel. And then it was, I mean, 28 Weeks Later is okay, but it's not the same type of feel.
Well, I think kind of what you alluded to, it makes some of those mistakes of like bringing in, making the world too big for the, you know, the thing that was great about A Quiet Place was that it was focused on this one family and it was so stark. both in its, you know, in the audio and how closely you had to listen. I never even thought about the fact that seeing in a theater, if you have like one jerk that, who did not silence their phone, like it could really ruin that experience.
And they don't play up the silence quite as much in this one. And maybe that helped just because I was in a theater, but they give more avenues for the characters to be able to talk, you know, for exposition and just for anything. And it also starts with a flashback of the first day these monsters show up, which is a very exciting sequence. And the scene where they go back to Main Street and it's kind of shot in a one-er. And there's this, I really like this camera work by John Krasinski, and, you know, and he's in the shot, so he directs it, but somebody else, you know, has to, I mean, and he wouldn't be the camera operator anyways, right. But either way, him being in the shot and being the director, it's really cool. There's like a hidden cut when he gets out of his truck and onto the street, and the way it kind of pans around him and everything. And it like, they don't do this, but it feels like those images, you know, sometimes in TV shows where they'll like change the aspect ratio for an action scene,
sure,
and you get that moment. It kind of feels like that, because now you're like, okay, the like the monster has landed on the ground and he steps out of his car to see what's going on. And it's like, and it, yeah, it just kind of opens up. And it, I thought that was a really well shot part of the movie.
Yeah. Well, and before we get too far away from it, the whole conceit of A Quiet Place, and then, you know, partially of part two, makes me think of No Country for Old Men, and how that's a movie that there's almost no soundtrack to, which is something that, like, the first time you watch No Country for Old Men, you probably don't even realize that there's almost no soundtrack in that movie.
Yeah.
And how much that changes the tone of a film just by omission, by making it seem so much more stark and lonely. And
have you ever seen those YouTube videos where people will take laugh tracks out of sitcoms and they're actually really sad?
Yes, it's kind of like that, right? Your ear is used to, with a film, being constantly entertained. It's used to being stimulated. Yes. And so, and of course, the conceit works in A Quiet Place because of the monsters and because of the premise that this family has a daughter who was born deaf and they use sign language and they have the tools to combat this situation more efficiently than probably most people in the world. Of course, as you and I were discussing ahead of time, both movies rely on every character having the worst luck possible all the time.
Yes, because, you know, this one, it after the flashback scene, it starts right where it left off, and they're getting out and they have a baby, you know, like an actual infant,
right?
So they have to put her in the little oxygen box so she doesn't make too much noise as they're trying to go, and they go, we have to go somewhere, and they light the girl goes up to the top of the like silo and lights the fire, and she sees the other fire, and they say, well, let's go out there. They always responded to Dad when he lit the fire, so it's somebody. And yeah, they know, and they go out there, and it turns out it's actually somebody from the flashback. So they knew each other as townspeople, families, whatever, but he's alone at this point, so it's kind of mysterious what's happened to his family. And that's Cillian Murphy's character.
Emmett.
But their first running with him is he set up these traps. And you were talking, the reason I got to this point is because you were talking about how they have the worst luck. They set up the traps and it drops this thing of bottles that makes a big loud noise. And Emily Blunt's character is just like, run. And they start running. And then the son steps in a bear trap, which is another trap, but that the guy set up. But oh, man.
Well, and you know, that's an interesting choice, because obviously he's setting it up, the noisy alarm, to alert him if something comes through the sort of, you know, what, let's call it a demilitarized zone. But of course, loud noises are also what attract these creatures. So if you have one hunting, you know, sort of perusing and hunting for you, and this loud noise happens, then you're just calling a bunch of them at once, I think. I mean, in this case, it sets up the first opportunity for Reagan, the teen daughter, the one who was deaf and has this cochlear implant. It sets up the first opportunity for her to try her sound gun, basically.
Yep.
That can kill these things. And so that's part of the conceit here too, is that now they're, rather than being afraid of the sounds, they're starting to be able to weaponize them to disable the creatures.
Yeah. So she's walking around with like the amp, and she can hook up her cochlear implant, the whatever the outer part is called, and set that up. And it does that like crazy loud feedback.
Right.
Looper. And so you mentioned the sounds and everything like that. The sound design is what these movies and get, you know, talked about for, and rightfully so. Like I said, I really like the camera work as well. But yeah, there's you don't get it quite as much in this one. I will say that's one. It's it's sort of refreshing because you do have so many questions after the first one that the characters get to talk more and everything like this. And then they bring Cillian Murphy's character. He brings them into like this like underground hideaway he has. I don't know where he's at, like some sort of like old coal refinery or yeah. I don't know what to call it, but whatever. And he, to like hide from the monsters, they're able to go in this like furnace type thing.
Right.
That,
I think it's a, supposed to be a, up like, and then it's like a steel foundry, I believe.
Something like that. Yeah. It's very industrial.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about that. Like, because we, you know, we were talking that the thing that A Quiet Place does so well and that this movie picks up on is that there's just nothing wasted. If John Krasinski shows you something or drops some tidbit, you can guarantee it's coming back. And in this case, yes. Some of those things got wrapped up in part two. Were you satisfied with that, or did you feel like it was almost like it spent too much time on answering questions from the first one, or what was the balance like on that, did you think?
This is what I would call a screenplay movie, which is while you're watching it, and maybe not everybody would notice this, maybe just because I like movies so much and I watch so much extra commentary on movies. Yeah. So like I kind of like the nuts and bolts of the movies beyond just, you know, the movie itself. But as I'm watching it, like it got to the point where I was like, okay, like they wouldn't do that unless that comes back and that comes back. And to his credit, it's not bad because he does call back on all these things. There's a moment in the flashback where the daughter teaches the sign for dive. Cillian Murphy's character uses that later. Here, I've got a little list of the
I didn't mean to make you jump ahead.
No, you're good. So she teaches them the dive sign. There's a boat that they let loose that ends up letting the monster get to a different part later in the movie. They show you the oxygen is running low. Now, that one's a pretty normal one that you would expect, and then they're running out of oxygen, so that's kind of a ticking clock on that one. The Cillian Murphy's character, the people that are left are not worth saving. That obviously comes back.
Right.
And the big one, while we were talking about this industrial place they're hiding and they're in that furnace or whatever it is, and when he closes it, he has to put a towel over where the locking mechanism goes. So one, it doesn't make too much noise. And two, it doesn't lock in so they can open it and stuff.
Right.
And then I'm like, and like immediately when I saw that, I was like, okay, that's going to like
fall at some point.
Thing. That's yeah. So I don't know, for other people, I guess that would be something interesting if you're listening to tweet in at us at nerd_associ when you're watching this movie or any other movies, do you notice things like that? Or do you feel like, I remember that now when they finally do pay off on the comeback? Cause I'd be interesting to see if that's like a drawback at all for people. And it's not a bad thing because it's the worst one is when you put things out there that seem interesting or seem like they could come back and then you don't do anything with it. So I give credit to John Krasinski and it's a really tight screenplay, but for me, it just felt like a little obvious, like that's going to come back. That's going to be a thing. That's going to be a thing.
Yeah. And the problem is like, how do you do that obviously enough to catch people's attention, but not so obviously to beat them over the head with it? Because, you know, you run into that problem where if it's too subtle, maybe you have to see the movie two or three times to get it.
And then you run into the problem that if you don't set up anything, people are like, well, how did he know the sign for dive?
Right.
And then the internet people come in with their movie sins and plot holes.
I think those are called trolls. They live under bridges and they feed off of your anguish.
You don't need to set up everything in a movie. It's nice when things get called back, but sometimes it's just like, I can get to the point where it's like, okay, it makes sense that he would know that or that might happen.
Yeah. You and I were talking ahead of time that these movies feel to me a lot like a session of D&D where, for those of you who may have that connection, where the dungeon master like intentionally sets up the most challenging situation for the players, knowing they have like just enough of the right tools to get through them. And there's occasionally there's occasionally this thing in D&D where, you know, the DM through either, you know, themselves or through a non-player character, like a, you know, one of the, because the DM plays all the other characters in the world that aren't played by your, you know, players around the table, where a player will say, well, would my character know that? And you kind of have to decide on the fly, like, would your character know it? Or do we roll dice to figure out like what the chances are? There are moments in these movies that kind of make you think, that sort of a, like they like if they didn't set it up, you'd almost be a DM being like, well, let's roll a die to see if you know it. Sorry, you had a question.
My question was because this happens in this movie, would this be something that you might set up if you were a dungeon master in Dungeons and Dragons, where the group gets separated and they're like simultaneously going through their own challenges that like, and then, but eventually somehow they do link up at the end, and like they, because they're happening simultaneously, if they both reach their goal, then they succeed together or they would fail apart.
Yeah, so there's this idea in D&D that's been around since the beginning. It's like a joke, and it's something you just say like as a meme around the table, which is don't split the party, because almost always something really terrible happens when you split the party and the right character that to handle that situation isn't present, or you know, the person who splits off on their own, you know, to look at this example of A Quiet Place, runs into a monster that they have no hope of defeating themselves. And when you're alone in a game like D&D, you're just a lot more vulnerable. And so even watching movies, I will sometimes, and this, these movies are a good example of that, where you would look at it and go, oh no, don't split the party. That's a bad idea. Because it's, yeah, it's a common thing to like run different parts of your group in tandem and try to do that cinematic thing where two scenes are going on at once and they don't necessarily have direct impact on each other, but like, the success of both is imperative to everyone getting back together and living and having something closer to a happy ending. So no, I mean, not to make this a podcast about D&D, which we should do sometime. but obviously, D&D borrows from movies, and a lot of filmmakers are, as I've learned, are D&D players and use these ideas when they're writing a script. I don't know about John Krasinski. I would not be surprised that he's a D&D player. He strikes me as the kind of guy who maybe played in high school or college or something. Yeah. So. Anywho, that is what it made me think of, is how, you know, you set up these really challenging situations where like lots of bad things can happen, but the players have like just enough resource to take care of it. But, you know, at what cost? You're watching a movie. You want to be entertained, right? You want there to be dramatic tension, but you kind of hit the nail on the head that they like it. It makes you realize that this is a movie with a script and everything has been written within an inch of its life. And that's not a bad thing. But it can sort of interfere with your immersion sometimes when it's when that's the case. You had mentioned like you know, the potential of what, like what is too obvious and hitting you over the head, and what could be too subtle. And I think this is one of the reasons I like spoilers, because I like to go into a movie the first time and watch it, and not have to watch a movie two or three times if I don't want to get everything. If you already know the plot before you walk into a movie, you can pick up on those clues a lot more easily. You know what I'm saying? So just, in defense of spoilers, they make you have that richer rewatching experience the first time.
Speaking of the plot, there's the inciting incident when they're with Cillian Murphy. He says, you can't stay with me. But she's like, well, we have to fix my son's leg. He stepped in your bear trap.
Yeah.
And while they're trying to get him to calm down, they're scanning through a radio while he has headphones on. And then they hear a song playing. So some sort of radio station is still broadcasting. And this is the inciting incident. Yeah. And this one, I like that they let, you know, you kind of let you figure out as you go on. You didn't immediately know what was going on, which is probably why for movie sense they did it this way. Yeah. But in real sense it doesn't make any sense, because the radio station is actually like a we're safe, you know, homing beacon, come here if you can, and we found a way to kind of work around the monsters. And they're playing
Beyond the
Somewhere
Sea, right?
Beyond the Sea. Yeah. Yes. And that's, and the girl figures it out, and she's the, like, you know, quote unquote code breaker for this. And she's like, there's a radio station. She's got a map and it's got the radio station. She's like, there's a radio station just over, you know, just over the valley. If you go out, you know, just a little bit into the ocean, there's an island that has a radio station. This has to be where it's coming from. It's beyond the sea. Right. So I guess spoiler alert, people, sorry.
I have a question about that. because I was reading the plot synopsis and not seeing the movie. Is there also a message attached that says like, survivors come to the radio station, or do they've just left a puzzle?
That's my thing, is like, okay, for the movie part, that kind of helps, because then the girl gets figured out, then it kind of gets explained to you and you're like, oh, okay, that's clever. But my question is, do they think only good people can solve riddles, or like, what is the reason for it being a code or a riddle to figure out in order to come to this island and find salvation?
Well, and maybe I just completely missed this somewhere. Can the aliens understand English? I mean, I know they can hear sounds, but like, do they think that the aliens could? Well, I guess maybe they just don't know enough. But are they thinking?
But the alien would then have to be by the radio and turn on the radio
and hear the signal and go, "Oh, this government broadcast. You know, I'm just freshly done eating someone's throat. This government broadcast says to go to this island." Like,
yeah,
encrypt it that way? Again, D&D, it's what it makes me think of, because that's the kind of thing you would do to, like, leave a little puzzle for your players.
Anyway. Yeah, but, like, usually when you do that, it's like a character that, like, a Joker-type character or something that's, like, messing with, well, I guess it would be the Riddler, but you know what I mean? Like, a character that's, like, maybe messing with the protagonist or something like that. But no, these are seemingly good people on this island trying to tell people that, hey, it's safe on this island, come see us. But you have to figure out this riddle first, and that seems counterintuitive to the point of it.
Maybe it's just to make sure not too many people come, but I don't know.
Bad people can figure out riddles, too.
They can. Well, yeah, you just said the Riddler, and Joker does that kind of crap, too. Yeah, it's almost always the bad people who decide to give an obtuse clue to what they are trying to say as opposed to actually just saying it.
So either way, the girl figures out the riddle. She goes out on her own, and then they find out she goes out on her own, so then Cillian Murphy goes to get her, and she falls into not a trap, but she's working around and she makes a bunch of noise on an abandoned subway. A monster comes for her and she does her thing, and she's trying to shoot it, and she connects with a shotgun, but doesn't, like, it's not a fatal blow. So even though the sound is debilitating to the monster, it's not
dead.
It's not paralyzing.
Yeah.
So it's working its way towards her, and then Cillian Murphy kills it, and then they meet up. So I don't want to do a scene by scene, but that was a really good scene where there was a lot of tension. And because she's deaf, she doesn't, it like flips where the monster hears her and goes to see her, but she's not looking in that direction.
Right.
So you see it in the background, and she's in the foreground, the monster come in. And so you see it before her, and that added tension is cool. And like I said, how it flips it, how the character we're focused on is the one who can't hear, while the monster's the one who can super hear.
Yeah. No, that is very interesting. Well, and they set up Cillian Murphy's character the whole time to kind of be, you're not really sure about his motives. He's clearly like this sort of down and out, doesn't trust the world.
He's very vague about what happened to his family.
Right. And then, of course, that comes back and is a shocking moment with the
sort of a Norman Bates moment.
Right. Can I, one other question, because I don't know if this is ever answered in this movie. How far removed from the events of the first movie is this? Well, you said it picks up right where the first one left off.
It's directly after. There's like the fire's still burning.
Yeah.
The water's still filling up their basement and everything.
And so I forget how long, because you said the movie starts with this like dramatic scene of the aliens landing, for lack of a better term. How long are we between that and where we are in the rest of the movie?
And they give you that. I don't know if they give you, I don't think they give that more specifically in the first one. So they give you that in this one. Because it says day one at that opening scene flashback.
Okay.
And then when it goes to the current story, I don't remember the exact one, but it was day 470 something.
So like a year and odd months in.
Yeah, 15 months or so.
So if Emmett's wife is like mummified, how long has she been dead? Like a long time.
That's a good point. Yeah, I don't. I'm not an expert on exactly how
mummification.
That works,
why aren't
starts,
you?
But yeah, you're right. I should have studied my mummification before I got on this podcast today. But yeah, that is a good point. That's, you know, like how long? Because he seems pretty good at dealing with the situation. So his wife was sick and in pain.
Okay.
So that was another reason why she wasn't able to survive. But either way, you think he would have tried to hold out as long as possible. And yeah, she seems to be, like I said, in like a Norman Bates situation where, it looks like she's been there for years, but it's barely been a year regardless.
Yeah. I just was curious. Well, and I guess, you know, in a bad situation like this, maybe it wouldn't be that hard to give up on humanity pretty quickly, but we're like a year in and he's already like, I'm a grizzled, hardened man. I've lost everything and I don't believe in people. Like
he says that anybody left ain't worth saving. Right. And that comes back. But one thing I really liked about the movie, and it doesn't make this mistake, while that does come back when they're at the docks looking for the boat to get to the island, they meet this group of, I don't know, it's like, they're not like in Spike shoulder pads, but it's kind of like Mad Max, like type people, you
it's
know,
like colony.
yeah, their teeth's all terrible, and they're you know, they're just like the worst type of people, and they trick them by having a little girl be out there on the dock, and then she like zip ties or whatever a bottle or a bag of bottles and stuff. So similar to his little trick. So now he's making noise and the monster's coming. Then he uses the sign for dive to tell the girl to dive in the water, because he thinks, oh, we'll probably be safer, you know, in the water. It
right.
offers more cover than just standing on a dock. He gets, and then those people get involved with the monster, and then he dives in. And this is a part that I was like, and it made me think of Signs, because I was thinking during the movie, I was like, I'm kind of glad we're past like the point in these movies where like these aliens come and they're going to take over and they're so much more powerful than us. And then it's like something really like mundane, or not even mundane, but something so prevalent in our world that kills them. Because in Signs, it's water. They can't get wet. And it's like, well, our Earth is like all water. Like, why would they come to this planet? In War of the Worlds, it was like germs.
Yeah.
Just your run-of-the-mill germs. And it's like, they didn't do the research to know we had germs. And then in this one, these apex predators who have completely taken over at least the eastern United States in 400 some days can't swim.
Yep.
They can't swim. They drown. And it's not like they struggle. They straight up can't. They're a rock. Once they're in the water,
yeah,
dead.
I know what you're saying. It's like awfully convenient, but you're talking about creatures that in every case are apex predators in their own territory. Like where they're from, they're an apex predator, right?
Yeah.
But it's like an invasive species. You know, sometimes you introduce a species into a new place and it just really thrives and it can, you know, kick ass or whatever. But there are environmental factors that either make it able to kill everything else and take over, or, you know, make it self-destruct. I mean, that's a thing in the real world. I get where you're coming from. It's awfully convenient.
For me, it didn't ruin it for me. And the movie's made really well, so it's fine. And it, you know, it advances the plot and it makes sense of why the people are safe on the island. And when they get to the island, the people are being loud. They're doing whatever they want because the monsters can't get there. But it was funny because earlier in the movie, I had that thought about Signs and War of the Worlds.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, I'm glad this movie doesn't have like a stupid reason why they're not like able to fully take over. And then
I mean,
20
know,
minutes later it happened. That's the only reason I was
the thing. Just like counterpoint to that. The thing that always bothers me with this argument, and I really like Signs, and so I'm willing to defend it, but also sort of this, isn't it convenient trope? Yeah, there's water on Earth's surface, but there's a difference between, and people are like, well, there's humidity in the air. Isn't that going to kill them? Well, there's a difference between humidity in the air and 100% water. There's a difference between,
you can't drink the air when it's high humidity.
Like we're in the midst of summer and it's high humidity, but like you're not in a swimming pool. And like we need oxygen to breathe, but like the Earth's atmosphere is something like, I don't know, 10% oxygen. If we had pure oxygen, it would just ignite spontaneously and kill us all. Like it's a matter of degrees, right?
Yeah. And I'm going to get to these some questions that I think it appears there's going to be a third one to
sure,
me.
Sure.
Some questions that I think the third one can answer that would help with some of these like little, these are things that like I'm still giving them credit that they could explain this away in the third one.
Yeah.
And the movies are made very well that it's okay. I'm not too worried about it. It's just something that popped in my
mind. And I'm not necessarily coming down on you, but you kind of mentioned earlier like how the internet loves to make its 70 plot holes that the stupid filmmaker obviously didn't think of. Like, actually, if you applied a little critical thinking to some of these, they might make perfect sense. If a tiger is great, but it can't survive in the ocean. Like, a tiger is an apex predator of its own environment, but it doesn't, like, it's
but
not
it can
gonna
swim a little bit.
Sure.
But either way,
yeah,
I got so mixed up on this plot hole that in the end, I don't really care about all that much.
Yeah, like I know. I'm just
but I forgot my main point, because they meet up with these people. Oh, people aren't worth saving. And then they find a way to kind of get the upper hand on it and escape. But what I like is because they do that by having the monsters come in, and it's almost like this moment of like daddy's home. Like
yeah.
The monster is still the main threat in this world, and too often post-apocalyptic type things, when it's monster based or zombie based or something like that. They go away from that too much. And this is what happened to The Walking Dead, and why The Walking Dead became uninteresting to me, is because the zombies were just like part of the world and they were like a nuisance. But the main problem were the people. And like, then it was just the same season over and over and over again.
Right. Cause that's interesting.
There's always some guy who's like this terrible person. And it's like, that's not interesting anymore.
It's interesting until it's overdone, right? It's always about balance, because it's also not interesting if everybody gets along perfectly and you just are constantly shooting zombies in the head. Like, it needs to be, there needs to be a middle ground. And I think what you're saying is,
but you need to ground it in, no matter who you are, good guy, bad guy, getting along, not getting along, wherever you're at, and you know, maybe it's just a disagreement, whatever it is. The real threat in this world should be the monsters. And they kept that in this one. And I appreciated that a lot.
Right. No, I agree with you. And I think while it is interesting to highlight a person whose personality is like, I don't know, I'd rather let you die to the monsters than ensure both of our survivals. Like, that's interesting, mm-hmm. but yeah, that can quickly derail. And it's a trope at this point, right? That like right. you expect.
Oh, the people are the real monsters.
And that's, again, that is interesting in moderation. But no, I think it's good when truly the monster of the movie is the thing that's scary. About the movie. Yeah.
So then you feel like they're great. They get to this island and they're just shocked. These people are having a bonfire, making all the noise they want, playing music, whatever. And they're just both like aghast. Like, what's going on here?
Right.
And then they go, well, yeah, we actually did see one drown. And they're basically like, yeah, can't swim. So we're cool on this island. Although I feel like what ends up happening where one is on like the drift boat and ends up getting on their island, it's like, maybe not that exact scenario, but I still feel like they should have a few more precautions than just like living life like normal.
Sure.
But they were just
I mean, yeah, like, because these creatures are clearly not shown to be like intelligent to the point of using tools. But if it's smart enough to figure out it can drift on a piece of like on a boat, it's only a matter of time before they've you know, there's a big enough log that they can drift on or something like that. You would
exactly.
think you would do the bare minimum.
No, they were basically just living like it was normal. And yeah. like, I hope the rest of the world's fine. We put on that song for you. Good job figuring it out. So then they go on the island. Monster gets in. Hell ensues. These things, they give you a lot more look at the monsters in this one. And they're big. They have these they're kind of spiderish, but I think they're only four limbs. But like they've got this like claw, and it's not even really a claw. It's like a... I don't even know what to call it, but it's just like an L shape, and it's just sharp, and it can cut through anything, and they can run. They're trying to drive away from it in a car, and it's keeping up with them when yeah. they have to be going at least 30, 40 miles an hour or something like that. And they right. do eventually lose it. So it's not as fast as a car, but it's close. It's much faster. And that's why once it sees you and hears, or once it hears you, it doesn't see at all. You're done. It will get you.
Yeah. A Quiet Place was based on a book. And my understanding is then, you know, A Quiet Place 2, using those characters in a new story. It's interesting how basically they were like, okay, what are the scariest predators on Earth, and how can we throw them all together? And it was like, okay, a tiger, we got a tiger, we got a spider, we got like, it's like a scorpion, but it's a big scythe instead of a poisonous spike. Yeah. Like, what? How can we
kind of like this? a bat with like sonar or something
right.
like that too? Like,
yeah. I don't know. That's just interesting to me how that, you know, we take let's take all the things people are scared of when it comes to apex predators and throw them into one. Except swimming. They forgot a great white.
Can't swim. Yeah. So they get to the island, and it doesn't go great, but the girl does eventually get to put her hearing aid thing on the microphone so that it's always broadcasting this. Although I was thinking they're gonna have to keep up, like they're gonna need like a battery schedule to like replace the battery in the thing, but that's a detail that doesn't really matter. It just, again, popped in my head.
And I always love when radio stations come up, especially in any right. movie, but in the post-apocalyptic movies or apocalyptic movies. I love that stuff. And I just think, and this is such a clever use of that, but I don't know. I'm a sucker for when it's like, oh yeah, little radios. Yeah. Radio. Yeah.
So, yeah. And then you think about it, like if somebody else can figure this out, not just her family, and also she gets it broadcasting just in the nick of time for her family to use it and to kill the monster that's cornering them.
Right.
So that's, you know, that's what I was talking about, where like they're doing different things, but then at the end they have to succeed at the same time.
Sure.
For it to work. I guess they don't. She doesn't really need them to succeed, but she does because she's doing this for her family.
Right.
She's not doing this just for herself, but she is just as courageous as her dad. Good for her.
I mean, that's a, you know, you talked about that being a D&D thing, and of course it is, but like, I mean, Star Wars did that back in the day, right? You have to turn off the shield generator before you can blow up the Death Star, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
So it's certainly compelling, and it's like the more threads you have going on that rely on one another, the more tension is ratcheted up when something goes wrong. And of course, as you're talking about now, there's a time limit too. It's not mm-hmm. a time limit they know, it's not a time limit they can count down, but narratively speaking, it's only so long until.
So yeah, when you're watching her, it's not just, oh, they better get that hearing aid on the microphone so that they can kill the monster that's attacking them. It's on top of that. Right. You're like, she better do that so her mom doesn't get killed by the monster too.
And by virtue of her deciding to leave with the one weapon that we know can kill them and leaving her family without that weapon, she has set that timer herself.
Because even Emily Blunt, the mother, she blows up a... And she does this more strategically to set off some sprinklers too, because it can't hear as well
right.
with the water hitting everything. But she blows up, you know, an oxygen tank. And next to it, and it seemingly lights on fire, big explosion next to it. It just walks right through it.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I mean, it blows it back for a second, but it doesn't really do it. So
yeah,
these monsters, except for this sound that makes them open up their little, I guess their head is like one giant ear. And it like has those panels that need to open up, and then you can see like the soft gushy parts of it, and that's what you have to kill. Unless you can do that, it doesn't seem like there's anything on Earth. I mean, save for like military level bombs, they haven't gotten that far,
right.
So maybe that would work. But those also make a lot of noise. So how are you going to get it to it?
Yeah. Do you have thoughts about questions that were left unanswered, a potential part three? What do you think is next in the A Quiet Place series? Where do we go?
I think definitely they're setting up for a third one. I think the third one is a good opportunity to kind of open it up a little bit more and maybe introduce a congruent story or something going on at the same time, and like seeing like how is the rest of the world dealing with this? How is the rest of the world going? Because with the swimming thing, it makes me think, okay, either these are localized to one spot or you know, a roughly one spot in North America, or just a side of the United States, whatever's going on, or it's everywhere because they dropped off enough of these. And they do talk about, there's a little news broadcast that talks about like an explosion in China or somewhere in Asia, and it's like, okay, so that kind of lets you know that like, oh, maybe this, whatever this event was, whatever this ship blowing up, whatever it was that dropped them there, maybe this was happening all over the world, but I would like to know that. So I think the third one has a good opportunity to actually get a little bit bigger. And now we've seen the story with the family, and now they know a good way to kill it and a safe place to be from them. Not that it's obviously not fully safe, but you don't have to be looking over your shoulder to whisper a word every minute of every day if you can get to an island.
It's interesting how I don't know that I've ever seen an alien invasion movie where they... Because you alluded to this, that like it would be interesting if they just dropped in North America and you had these other places in the world where they didn't have it. It's alien movies.
And they're just like watching North America just
like fall apart,
crumble.
Which, at some point, because of land masses, like South America, given enough time, South America would get it too. But like in a virus movie or a zombie movie, it's often like, oh, someone got on a plane in London and they landed in New York. And now that's what takes the pandemic from one continent to another, right?
But yes, one of these monsters is not going to get on a plane.
Or if they do, it's not coming
security.
Across the pond. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
They have their. I'm sorry, sir. You don't have your passport.
Wait. You're two of the sound monsters in a trench coat.
Yeah.
He's got like a little hat on, a little briefcase.
That's so good. Anyway, okay. So you know, seeing potentially other places in the world where this is happening, or following another story that sort of lines up with this one. What else?
I want to know a little bit more about the monsters, and because this is the biggest. This one is a true nitpick for me. I want to know a little bit more about what they hear, why, not why they hear, but like, why are they so interested in things they hear? Because based on what we learned from the movie, why aren't they just constantly attacking birds or like always running through the forest because they hear something rustling? Why don't they hear another one running around and thing? Maybe there's a little bit more communication about unique sounds and things like that. And like I said, I'm leaving it open that they could maybe still somewhat explain that a little bit. And they did a little bit in the first one because there's the waterfall scene where John Krasinski brings his son down to the waterfall and he's like, we're able to talk here because
it baffles the sound.
It covers up the sound and they're not interested in the sound because it's consistent. And they've figured out that's a water. And
it's water. That they're afraid of running water, source of water. But no, you're right. I mean, again, if you look at apex predators in the wild, like tigers aren't eating grubs. They are following sounds that sound like the things they like to eat. But you're right. Why aren't they chasing deer? Why aren't they, chasing horses?
Anytime a human makes noise, reckless abandon charge in and just start slashing at anything that they hear.
So there is clearly some intelligence
here. It seems like if that was the base level of their existence, that they would constantly be doing that. Maybe there's a hive mind. Maybe there's like a more centralized like queen bee that is like telling them what to do. That would be interesting, I think. But then you might be getting a little too far into alien territory.
Well, I was going to say this movie has so many like small elements that like are slightly Lovecraftian. But it certainly you would not consider it a Lovecraftian horror, except that just the monsters are weird. Mm-hmm. It would start getting into that sort of territory if they all shared like a psychic link and there was an overlord and it knew all and saw all. That would start getting into Lovecraft territory as opposed to just like alien movie territory.
Yeah, the idea of like the xenomorph from the alien movies is something that also popped in my head because they seem like, yes, a very elite predator and can exterminate something, but they don't seem bright enough to have mastered space travel on their own. So why are they here? Who sent them here? Were they just on an asteroid that blew up? Were they like this like weird thing that developed out in space? But in space, you can't hear anything. They would be a really poor space creature.
Well, so here's the question. Looking at a part three, I agree with you that it would be interesting to find that out. But we talked about this last week about like how you can magic the magic or science the science too much. Do you think it ruins the sort of mystery of it if you get into that level of detail? Or are you just like, nah, man, pull back the curtain. I want to know how they got here and what they're about.
Yeah, there is a certain point where it's like I said, I want there to be a little bit more and like see what's going on in the rest of the world. But you're right. I don't need like the government briefing scene where they're like, this is what we know about the monsters. And this is, so you're right. Maybe there is just a little bit better if they keep that in. The last group of questions I had, then these are the ones that I think the third could totally be open to answer, but doesn't have to. And like I just said, some of them could be okay to be left open to interpretation. Has anyone else figured out the feedback frequency thing?
Right.
That one is the one I want to see for sure.
Yes.
I want to see if anybody else has figured this out or if their message has gotten to other people and other people have used it, something like that. They can't be the only people who have figured out that an extremely high feedback frequency is something that incapacitates the monsters. Yeah. Are they all over the world? I already went over that one. I don't need, like I said, I don't need the big briefing scene, but something that tells me they're somewhere other than North America. Because basically, if they're on any continent across the sea, they can get presumably anywhere. I mean, there's land to get to Africa from Europe and to Asia, correct?
Correct. Yeah, Australia and Antarctica would be the only ones that would have to be like, well, and all the Pacific Islands. But yes, the big continents of Asia and Europe and Africa all have land bridges. North and South America do too. So the only thing that would be untouched from those landings would be Australia and Antarctica, which is probably where they probably came from Antarctica.
Maybe inadvertently, Van Halen saved South America because of Panama and the Panama Canal. And then there's water there and they can't get across. It's a pretty stretch joke, but I wanted to go with it.
Yeah, no, sorry, I didn't. I was just thinking you meant because Van Halen and all of those guitar screeches at first, but
that would work too.
Yeah, I think that's probably where your joke should have gone, but you chose Panama, so we all had to witness it.
Speaking of, you were talking about the Antarctica and Australia and the Pacific Islands. How many islands are just fine?
I would probably like to know about that. Because they can't swim.
And like,
there.
Why aren't you? But it's so hard to communicate because you can't do any sound. So yeah, like the people are probably so frustrated that like, we could save people, but I don't know how.
We could just send emails, so, man.
Those are the things I'm interested in from a part three. It doesn't have to be all of them, but just places you could go.
Sure.
That would be nice to get some answers. Like we said, you don't need to answer all of them, but some of those answers.
Yeah. No, I agree. Overall, do you recommend it? And do you recommend taking your theater-loving self out of the equation? Is this worth going to the theater for, you know, maybe your first movie back? Or are people going to fall more in my camp and say, I'll just wait until July 12th and stream it somewhere?
It would depend on how quiet of like a movie viewing place you have available to you. If you've got a nice basement and stuff like that with a big comfy couch and a nice big TV and it's quiet and you can get it dark, you're probably okay to be at home. I thought it was fun. If it wouldn't be a detriment for it to be crowded as long as nobody is being, it might even be more fun. One of those experiences where everybody's so into the movie and everybody freaks out at the same moment. And that's something you can get from the movie theater. So I unless you have somewhere where you can get it really quiet and everything, I would recommend going to the theater for it. The one drawback, and this is because there's not a ton of dialogue. The first one had this too. It's only 97 minutes long. And I know sometimes that feels like you're not paying for enough movie, but it leaves you wanting more, but the 97 minutes is still a satisfying movie from this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, it's good in an era of 2.5 hour or 3 hour Star Wars and Avengers movies. It's nice to have one. That's
it's nice to have a 90 minute movie sometimes. Exactly. That's something I'm because sometimes it seems like movies just make them that long because that's what people expect now. And it's like, it's okay. If your story only takes 95 minutes, that's fine. As long as it's a good story, and this is a good story.
Precisely. Well, folks, let us know what, you know, if you have seen A Quiet Place 2, let us know what you thought. If you are still on the fence about whether or not to go to the movie theater, I hope that we cleared some things up for you on that. You can reach out to us. Let us know what you thought. Let us know if you saw both of them, how you would compare them by finding us on Twitter. Our handle there is @NerdAssoc. That's NERD_ASSOC. You can email us at nerdassoc@gmail.com. Give us some of your ideas about what you'd like to hear us talk about, or maybe you can even come on and be one of our nerds. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.